Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Mohamed Morsi had 368 days in power as the president of Egypt. That counter ran out today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Wednesday, the 3rd of July. And maybe the best phrase to describe what's been happening in Egypt lately is fast moving. Remember, just a week ago, there were no crowds in Tahrir Square to speak of. Tonight, Mohamed Morsi is no longer in power. The constitution has been suspended. And new parliamentary elections, the army says, are coming. We talked to a small business owner in Cairo on Monday about what he wanted out of all this, and he was pretty clear.
We believe in army. We believe in army, and we trusted them so much.
Now that he's gotten that, now that that's happened, what happens next? What happens to an economy after a coup, which is what a lot of people are calling this? This is obviously a story that's going to play out over the next couple of days and years, but as often happens, if you want to know what's going on in the short term, you turn to the markets. Crude oil topped $102 a barrel today on the news from Cairo. It's up 5% so far this week. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith starts us off.
Egypt doesn't produce much oil, so why is the turmoil in Egypt rattling oil markets? Christopher Knittel is a professor of energy economics at MIT.
Egypt controls the Suez Canal and a number of important pipelines in the area.
Around 4 million barrels of oil go through the Suez Canal every day from all over the Middle East.
The only other way is coming around the Horn of Africa. Now, that is going to add weeks to the transport of this oil.
That's oil analyst Stephen Shork.
The longer the oil sits on a tanker transiting the ocean, well, your costs go up per day. Your fuel consumption to move the vessels goes up. It's going to cost you a lot more to get that oil to the market.
The markets are also worried that the political upheaval in Egypt will spread, says Jim Bushnell, a professor of economics at UC Davis.
Kind of spillover risk that unrest in Egypt could signal unrest in other parts of the Arab world that are oil producers.
It's all speculation for now, says Bushnell, but the implications are real. We're likely to see higher gas prices as soon as this weekend.
Usually when crude oil prices increase, the effects are seen at the pump very quickly.
The fact the U.S. is producing more of its own oil and importing less won't help, says Bushnell. He says oil is a global product, so any disruption in production anywhere affects the price of oil everywhere. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Today, I guess, is a day of stories that are going to take a while to play out. It seems the Obama administration has changed its mind about a key part of healthcare reform. It's going to delay something called the employer mandate for a year until 2015. It's the part of that law that obliged big companies to offer health insurance to their full-time employees or pay some stiff penalties. It seems the whole thing is just too much of an administrative mess right now to put into effect. And Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia. That in itself is creating a whole new kind of waiting game.
First, a little perspective. University of Pennsylvania health economist Mark Duggan says the delay of the employer mandate isn't going to affect a lot of people.
We've got 6 million companies in the U.S., and something on the order of 10,000 companies are 50 or more employees and not offering coverage, so it's a tiny fraction.
But for those companies who don't offer coverage, health tax attorney Don Susswine says today is a beautiful day.
This gives people another year, in effect, to really find out more, make the decisions they have to make.
Susswine says this really gives employers time to do the math, to figure out how to offer insurance at the lowest cost to themselves and shift the bulk of the burden to their employees.
The employers are going to realize, for the most part, that this is not as bad as they thought it was.
It might not be as bad for some employees either. Individuals will still be required to have insurance starting next year. But instead of choosing an expensive policy offered at work, Judy Solomon with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says they can shop for insurance on the exchanges.
For some people, if they were going to have an offer of coverage that was not as strong or as comprehensive as what they could get on the exchange, this delay might actually be helpful.
In practice, the rollback of the employer mandate is small. But Giovanni Colella at Castlight Health says when it comes to perceptions about Obamacare, this could be huge.
And that's what I'm hearing from everybody. This proves that it wasn't ready. Now the question is, will it ever be ready?
We'll get the first signs of that on October 1st when the insurance exchanges are scheduled to open. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders packed it in early for the July 4th holiday and went home or to the beach or wherever they went. They were buying before they went. Though we'll have the details when we do the numbers. The reason we spend so much money in this country fighting wildfires, and so indirectly the reason those 19 men died in Arizona earlier this week, is because we're trying to protect homes and buildings. Structures is what firefighters call them. But despite the hundreds of structures that have been lost this summer, ever more people are building their dream homes out in the forests. There are things they can do to make those houses less likely to burn, but that is usually a hard sell, as Megan Verlee reports now from Colorado Public Radio.
Ask fire mitigation specialist Keith Worley about the vulnerability of mountain developments, and he can tell you firsthand. A decade ago, a wildfire threatened his own neighborhood southwest of Denver. Worley helped a fire crew map out its strategy for protecting homes.
And they were using kind of a green, yellow, red.
Greenhouses might be saved, yellow were tougher, and red, well, the firefighter just referred to those as historic.
And for him, the red meant it's history.
In the 10 years since, Worley's tried to persuade mountain homeowners to protect their property. Mitigation is expensive. It can cost thousands of dollars to do things like clear brush, thin trees, and install rocky, fireproof landscaping. So Worley's heard a lot of excuses.
Number one, I pay my taxes, and when I dial 911, I expect the fire department to be here. Number two, I've got insurance, and so if this burns down, I'm going to just replace it.
Those stubborn homeowners may not have insurance for long, though. Companies are getting increasingly tired of absorbing wildfire losses. Carol Walker is president of the Rocky Mountain Insurance Information Association. She says the industry can't afford to ignore the risk of fire.
And insurers are increasingly requiring homeowners to share that risk and do the mitigation to make their property safer and to make it insurable.
In Colorado, more fire-prone counties are pushing developers to build in safety measures. That effort looks like it paid off during the devastating Black Forest fire last month. The flames mostly spared a newer neighborhood designed to be fire safe. Older homes nearby weren't so lucky. Touring the burn zone, regional building official Roger Lovell says mandatory mitigation is rarely popular.
And until recently, I would say that a number of people didn't exactly understand why that request was being made, too.
The message does seem to be getting through, though. Mitigation specialist Keith Worley says he usually stops getting calls about fire safety as soon as the summer smoke clears. But this past winter, his phone just kept on ringing. In Denver, I'm Megan Verlee for Marketplace.
The Portuguese finance minister has quit, as has its foreign minister, for that matter. And the government, along with, not coincidentally, the Portuguese economy, seems to be a little bit shaky. So we ask, as we do every now and then,
what's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
The BBC's Alison Roberts is in Lisbon, Portugal. Alison, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon here in Lisbon.
I've been trying to figure out, Alison, whether this is the same old economic crisis or a brand new political crisis. What do you think?
Well, of course, the fact that these countries, and in this case Portugal, have had to implement austerity policies has placed an enormous burden on its political system. So on the one hand, you have international lenders who are demanding that Portugal implement this very tough program of unprecedented tax cuts and huge spending cuts. And on the other hand, the public who are saying, we're not seeing any benefits at all from this, either now or at any time in the near future. And what we are seeing are big, big sacrifices.
Well, what does austerity look like over there? Are they cutting aid for mothers and children and the elderly? I mean, what are they doing?
There have been cuts absolutely across the board. I mean, both this year and last year, there were big cuts in what we often translate into English as bonuses for holiday and Christmas pay for public sector workers, but in fact are an integral part of their pay. And they've had large chunks of those bonuses suspended, supposedly temporarily, but the government never quite said when it would replace them. Then on the other hand, tax rises. This year, the state budget imposed tax increases that the finance minister himself described as enormous, and which for many people are equivalent to a month's salary. So that's the kind of order we're talking about.
What happens then next year when Portugal is supposed to get out from under its bailout and everything is supposed to, in theory, get back to normal? Private investors are supposed to come in. Is any of that going to happen now, do you think?
There had already been a lot of talk about the fact that Portugal would need some kind of help after next summer, whether it would be in the form of another multi-year bailout or something more short term. And what we may be seeing here effectively is within the governing coalition a bit of blame shoving, people seeing that this is going to come and wanting to make sure that the other half of the equation get the blame.
This is, I'd guess, the topic of conversation over there, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, I have to say, I've lived in Portugal for some years now, and whereas some years ago, people wouldn't necessarily want to comment on politics. When you stop them in the street, they say, oh, no, I don't have any opinion on that. Nowadays, everyone has an opinion, and usually it's a strong one, and they want to voice it.
Yeah. Alison Roberts with the BBC in Lisbon, Portugal for us. Alison, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Coming up,
the cheapest, most nutritious, and bountiful food that has ever existed in history, and it costs only a buck or two.
Think Golden Arches, people. Freakonomics Radio straight ahead, but first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street largely avoided the fireworks in markets elsewhere today in shortened trading ahead of the 4th of July. The Dow Industrials ticked up 56 points, nearly 0.4%. Closed at 14,988. The NASDAQ climbed 10 points, 0.3%, 3443 for the palindromically inclined that among you. The S&P 500 eked out a one-point gain, basically flat, ended at 1615. Today's pyrotechnics came from Europe. The Roman candle this time wasn't in Athens or, you know, Rome anyway. The Portuguese government drove things down. Lisbon stock index slipped more than 5%. For context, that's like a 750-point drop on the Dow, by the way. Some notables on Wall Street. Tesla Motors downshifted 2%. Today, International Speedway raised up 3% on strong profits. The company owns Daytona and 12 other racetracks. Bond prices? Well, here you go. The yield on the 10-year up to 2.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. No trading tomorrow. Markets are closed. It's a holiday, people. You probably have the day off, giving you ample opportunity to observe National Hot Dog Month and National Grilling Month, conveniently scheduled simultaneously. And the Statue of Liberty reopens to the public. Lady Liberty hosted a lot of repair people on her island after Superstorm Sandy flooded the grounds. She's back in business. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. You want to buy a car. Most times you hustle down to the local dealer. You do some distasteful but perfunctory haggling for a while, and you buy yourself a car. Should you be in the market for something more upscale, say one of those fancy new Teslas, you're out of luck. Tesla wants to sell its electric cars to you directly, not through a dealership like Ford or GM. That, though, is not going over well in a whole lot of states, which set the rules for who gets to sell what, where, and to whom. Thing is, businesses of all kinds have cut out middlemen, yet car dealers haven't gone anywhere. Marketplace's Mark Garrison digs into the how come.
When car dealers talk about themselves, they always say something like this.
In our state, we have over 87,000 employees.
And they never leave out this.
Motor vehicle sales tax.
That's Bill Walters, who runs the Texas Automobile Dealers Association. He wasn't really talking to me or you. He's aiming for political leaders elected to protect jobs and revenue. Car dealers provide both, which is why state politicians love them. But politics isn't the whole story, which goes back to the first cars, unreliable smoke-belching contraptions.
Cars in the good old days needed a lot of tender care.
That's University of Michigan professor Francine LaFontaine. Remember, dealers sell cars and fix them, too. Franchises gave Detroit some quality control over repair service. Over the years, dealers felt they needed more leverage. It started when car makers made dealerships upgrade repair technology. Edmunds senior editor Bill Visnick says that's when dealers started pushing for laws to tilt the playing field.
We have to have some guarantee on our side that we're not subject to the whims of the manufacturer if they would decide to cancel our franchise contract.
In the 70s, states passed strong laws protecting dealerships so car makers couldn't go around them. Online ventures and automakers, large and small, have all tried and failed since. Tesla has a tough fight ahead. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
There was a pretty substantial hiccup in global credit markets last week. You might have missed it. It lasted just 24 hours, maybe not even that. China's central bank essentially froze all lending between that country's banks. It's a fairly drastic step, but they're trying to control the amazing rise in Chinese debt. In the past 3 years, China has piled on more debt than its entire economy is worth, in part by building big infrastructure projects, projects that sometimes don't work out so well. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz takes us now to one of them. It's a copycat of the island of Manhattan, being built just about an hour from Beijing.
Rockefeller Center? Check. Lincoln Center? Check. Hudson River? They've got that too. The city rising from a saltwater marsh in the port city of Tianjin looks an awful lot like New York City. But don't be fooled, says Lin Lishui. He's a dapper young spokesman for a local developer. This Manhattan replica aims to be a bigger apple.
Our goal is to create the world's largest financial center right here within 10 years. We're building skyscrapers. We've got China's largest high-speed railway station coming soon. We're building a tunnel under the sea, and we'll soon build several subway lines.
Lin sounds like a boy whimsically building sandcastles, and this is a very big sandbox. The city's called Yujiapu. It's now one of the biggest construction sites on the planet. Workers are completing dozens of skyscrapers, many over 50 stories tall. Zhang Xiaoying is a real estate analyst for Tianjin Centerline Property Consulting. Her job is to advise those who are interested in investing in this area. What is she telling them about China's next Manhattan?
No.
Don't invest here. It's way too risky. Some developers have resold entire buildings at a loss just so they can pull out of here as soon as possible. For the projects that are finished, the investors are now pulling out.
The way Zhang sees it, Yujiapu is more Detroit than Manhattan, and it hasn't even been built yet. So I ask her, why is it being built? Hu Jintao, Zhang says with a nervous giggle. That is, of course, China's former leader. Under his presidency, China's economy grew at an unprecedented rate. The formula for much of that growth has been pretty straightforward.
All the land belongs to the government.
That's Beijing-based economist Anne Stevenson Yang.
The government has the right to clear the land, to take it over, and then to either build stuff on it themselves, sell it to a developer, or use it as collateral for loans. They do all three, and they've made a killing doing it.
Stevenson Yang stands in the dirt of a narrow avenue between giant half-finished skyscrapers in Yujiapu. She says the Tianjin government took this land, assessed it at many times its current value, and then used that price as collateral for loans. She says Tianjin has borrowed nearly as much as its entire annual GDP to pay for Yujiapu. With China's economy now in slowdown mode, Stevenson Yang says the region's future is bleak.
Think of it. Every single dollar that's made in Tianjin, one for one, is lent to this particular district, which will be written off to no more than a tenth of its value. Where does that money go? It doesn't disappear. It becomes everybody's debt.
She predicts that 10 years from now, China's property bubble will have burst. Land will be worth around half of what it is now, and squatters will inhabit Yuzhapu's half-built skyscrapers, like something out of a Mad Max movie.
This is going to be apocalypse then. It's very, very sad. Look, I've lived in China for 23 years. I have a huge batch of Chinese in-laws. I like China. I wish that things were different, but I just don't see how they can be.
In the meantime, China's Manhattan Project marches forward, thanks in part to support at the highest levels of government. An ambitious former mayor of Tianjin, Zhang Gaoli, was the guy who helped secure funding for this district. What's he doing now? Vice Premier of China. After hearing Stevenson Yang's grisly predictions for Yuzhapu, I returned to the dapper young developer's office to ask a few more questions. Inside, the only sign of life is a receptionist. She's sleeping at the front desk. A tense-sounding piano tune plays over the PA system, echoing through the marble halls. In front of her desk are framed advertisements for the future city. One proclaims in English, "Concentrate world capital and set China's ambition." Outside, a city is being built, and the receptionist continues to sleep. In Yuzhapu, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. That moment every couple of weeks, we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is The Hidden Side of Everything. Dubner, how are you, man?
Kai, I'm great. Thank you.
All right.
Nice to talk to you. You like riddles, don't you, Kai?
I do.
All right. Let me try something out on you then. A listener of ours, a fellow named Ralph Thomas, recently asked us to weigh in on what he calls, quote, the cheapest, most nutritious, and bountiful food that has ever existed in history.
Wow.
He says it's got 390 calories, 23 grams of protein, substantial portions of calcium, iron, and it costs only a buck or two. So, Kai Rizdahl, let me ask you this. What food is Ralph talking about?
It's got to be like tofu or soy or some kind of thing, right?
God, you're smart.
I know.
But you're wrong. But you're wrong also.
You get it to me all the time, man. What is that?
It's the McDonald's McDouble hamburger.
No, it's not.
This is Ralph's argument. So, and you responded the way a lot of people respond.
Yeah.
We actually brought in a bunch of McDoubles here at WNYC for the staff. And this was definitely not a McDonald's crowd.
Yeah,
check this out.
All right.
Not nutritious at all.
Zero nutrition.
I would say from zero to kale. Technically, there are pickles, so I think they're vegetables.
They're not like real pickles, you know what I mean? It's like McDonald's somehow has engineered their own version of the pickle.
They're, you know, a piece of synecdoche for American mass, bland, synthetic corporatism.
All right, so a couple of things. One, synecdoche, good word. Two, I always did like McDonald's pickles. And number three, come on, that's like the public radio crowd. You heard the lady, zero to kale? Come on.
That is exactly right. And that's kind of my point. The more I thought about Ralph Thomas's question, again, whether the McDouble is the cheapest, most bountiful, and most nutritious food ever, the more I realized that how you answer that question says a lot about how you see the world, not only our food system, but also the economics of it and even social justice.
Whoa, dude, where is this coming from? What?
Well, we set up a little debate on the McDouble between two people. I'd like to play you some of that. One is a health food activist. The other is a sort of scholarly farmer. The activist is Tom Philpott. He's a food columnist for Mother Jones.
Okay.
And he says, sure, the McDouble is cheap, but that's because the price does not factor in all the external costs.
In order to present to us all that $2 burger, you're talking about a vast army of working poor people. And that doesn't even get to the farmer who grew the corn and soy.
Yep.
Okay, so on the other side is Blake Hurst, who is a corn and soy farmer, and he's the president of the Missouri Farm Bureau. Hurst points out that this vast army of working people are also consumers who benefit from low prices.
It's pretty easy to say everyone ought to get paid more. I'm in favor of that, particularly in my own case.
but pay is only good in so much as what it can buy. And what you can buy is a McDonald's cheeseburger for just a little over a buck in almost 14,000 restaurants. And that is a good thing.
All right. So value judgments aside, that's the cheap part of this equation. What about the bountiful thing you were talking about?
Well, as Blake Hurst points out, you know, 14,000 Mickey D's in the U.S. alone where you can pop in whenever you need a burger. And this highlights a larger issue that he feels is wildly overlooked.
The biggest unreported story of the last three quarters of a century, this increase in the availability of food for the common person.
And you know, so I'll give him that, right? I mean, that is generally speaking a good thing. You can't turn around nowadays without finding food.
Mm-hmm, that's right. In most places, that's absolutely true. According to the Global Food Security Index that The Economist publishes, the United States is number one in the world, meaning food is very bountiful. Now, that comes with its own problems, of course.
All right, but Dumner, listen, if the point of the original question is that if you had a bunch of people to feed cheaply and you wanted to feed them, you know, at least reasonably well, what would you give them? What's the answer?
Well, here's Tom Philpott's very Mother Jonesy idea.
You can get a pound of brown rice, organic, and a pound of red lentils for about $2 each. And a serving size, say a cup of each of those things, would be about 75 cents.
Okay, so that's that. And here's how Blake Hurst, the farmer, sees things.
Okay.
Yeah, but I rest my case. I'm sorry. There is no amount of marketing that is going to make me prefer brown rice and lentils over a McDonald's cheeseburger.
All right, well, so maybe he's got a point. Who won the debate, though, dude?
I'll let your listeners decide. You know, as you see, people have very strong opinions about this stuff, fact-based or otherwise. In my own home, I've got one kid who loves McDonald's and another who will not go anywhere near it. But that's how it kind of goes with these things. So I guess I've got to call Tom Philpott back to get some nice recipes for lentils and rice. I've got to feed my daughter.
Good luck on that one, man. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. Dubner, we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which social media once again conveniently capitalizes on a crisis, Twitter launched a translation service earlier this week. Tweets in Spanish and Italian and German rendered into English. Today, given the news from Cairo, it's offering English translations of the Arabic tweets from about 100 prominent Egyptians, including from people like Mohamed Morsi, the guy who until not too long ago was the president of that country. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up about 56 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 10, 0.3%. The S&P 500 up a single point. We'll call that basically flats. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. Enjoy your fourth, will you? And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.